Apologies, Doctor. We are honored that Dr. Chachanov is presenting from Winnipeg, Canada this morning. He's a distinguished professor of psychiatric at the University of Manitoba and director of the Manitoba Palliative Care Research Unit, Cancer Care Manitoba. His 250-plus publications address psychosocial dimensions of palliation and help define core competencies and standards of end-of-life care. And his work has explored various dimensions of palliative medicine, such as depression, desire for death, will to live, and dignity at the end of life. Welcome, Dr. Chachanov. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. It's my honor to be asked to be part of this lecture series. I understand in New Zealand it's bright and early, 7:30 in the morning. As was said in the introduction, here in Canada, it is in Winnipeg, it is Wednesday, 12:30 noon, and for those who are curious, the temperature is minus 12 Celsius. I'm going to be speaking to you about something that has been sort of a thread of my research for a number of years. In fact, reflecting back on this work, I can't help but think about the first time that I spoke in New Zealand, which was back in 1996. I spoke at the New Zealand Society of Palliative Care. It took my colleagues about 12 years to recover from that talk because I was then, that took place in Christchurch. And then I was invited in 2008 to speak at the University of Auckland, an event that was sponsored by the Mercy Hospice. So I'm going to be spending the next 30 or 40 minutes with time for questions afterwards, talking a little bit about dignity, why it is salient, why it's important for those of us who work in end-of-life care to be aware of the importance of dignity, not simply as a philosophical construct, but as something that has clinical salience at the bedside. Next slide, please. As I mentioned to you, I'm speaking to you from Winnipeg, and in the last few years, this has been a magnificent museum that is now featured in our skyline. And you can see that it's a glorious piece of architecture. It also happens to be very close to a hotel where we usually host our dignity therapy training. And in some ways, it seems to me that there's synchronicity between the mandate of trying to instill values around dignity in clinical work and the mandate of the Canadian Human Rights Museum. It's the first national museum to be built outside of our capital, Ottawa, Canada. If you had a chance to visit the museum and walk in, you would see on one of the walls is a magnificent display of the Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And Article 1 reads, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood." So in some ways, what you can hear is that the mandate of the Canadian Human Rights Museum is to, in essence, change the way we see our fellow man and woman, to see them as being worthy of dignity. And certainly when you look at the various displays that you would see as you walk through the Human Rights Museum, you'll understand that many of the atrocities, many of the injustices that have taken place over the millennia is when we fail to see the humanity in one another. For the remainder of the talk, what I'll be doing is really discussing what is the importance of taking that notion and bringing it to the bedside, helping us understand how dignity has salience, how dignity has relevance, and how dignity can inform the kinds of things we do with our patients and their families on a regular and daily basis. So, next slide, please. Let me back up to my beginnings, and my beginnings really came as a result of a paper that was published way back in 1996. As it happened, this was the year that I was doing my fellowship in psycho-oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering with the likes of Jimmy Holland, Kathleen Foley, William Breitbart, and for those of you who work in the area of palliative care and psychosocial oncology, those are names that are likely highly recognizable because they're really pioneers of the field of psycho-oncology and palliative care. In the year that I went to Memorial Sloan Kettering to do my fellowship, this particular article appeared in the American Journal of Psychiatry. The name of the article was, Is It Normal for Terminally Ill Patients to Desire Death? This was an article, as it happens, that was published by a group of my colleagues who were in Winnipeg at the time. The lead author was a psychiatrist who was a specialist in affective disorders, mood disorders, by the name of Jim Brown. They broached what you would think would be a seemingly fairly obvious question. You know, is it ever normal for people to desire life to be over sooner than later? Now recognize this was not a study of euthanasia or assisted suicide per se. This long predated legislation that came about in Canada about a year ago in medical assistance in dying. But this was looking at something much broader and much more general, and that is whether or not it was ever normal that patients who were nearing the end of life might actually covet death earlier rather than waiting out their days until death ensued. What they did was they screened about 44 patients, so it's a relatively small study. They found that there were 10 patients who expressed a genuine desire for early death. And what they reported is that all 10 patients, in fact, met criteria for concurrent depression. That is, they all were clinically depressed. And even though it was a small study, it was the first that really broached this issue, which is why it was published in the highly eminent journal, the American Journal of Psychiatry. And certainly it generated a great deal of conversation amongst my colleagues at Memorial Sloan Kettering during the time that I was there. Like all good research, however, it both answers questions and as well it raises a variety of questions. Now the question that it answered is it certainly seemed to say that there is some association between the wish for life to be over sooner and this construct of depressive illness. The questions that it raised, however, were, is that the only thing that really provides a plausible explanation as to why patients might want to die sooner than later? And for those of us who work in end-of-life care, it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination or recollection to think about patients who may have expressed, you know, as a feeling of anguish, the wish that they not have to go on in view of various symptoms they may have experienced, in view of family distress or lack of support that they may have perceived. And so we decided that perhaps it was time for us to take this study, which, as I said, was a small but important study, and to try and look at this in a much larger way. Next slide, please. As a result of this, we conducted a study that enrolled just over 200 patients. Now, like all of the studies that we did, these are patients who were enrolled in palliative care. It means they had access to quality, comprehensive end-of-life care. We have both an inpatient service as well as see people in the community. The average age of patients was in late 60s, early 70s. And as you might imagine, the vast majority of patients also had some form of an advanced malignancy. By the way, over time, I've been asked, what is it about Winnipeg that people keep on studying desire for death? And my response is, come visit us in January, and the answer will be self-evident. What did we find? Well, let me tell you a little bit about some of the findings, which I think you'll find of interest. Next slide, please. First of all, in a very simplistic way, we asked people to rate their desire for death on an ordinal scale that was modeled on the SADS interview, the Schedule of Affective Disorders and Schizophrenia. And you can see it laid out there for you from one being no desire for early death. About 55% of the cohort, in fact, said that they really had not dawned on them that they would want life to be over sooner than later. To those who scored 4 or greater, that has had a desire for death of moderate severity or greater. So this was a genuine, consistently held desire for death, and that comprised about 8.5%. So what can we conclude from this? Well, we can conclude that if about 55% of people at least on occasion, or I should say 45% of people at least on occasion, have a desire for early death, then it shouldn't be any surprise to us in our clinical work that not infrequently, this is something that patients might express as a form of expressing the anguish that they feel in the wake of anticipation of their death. But when you look for patients who have a genuine, consistent desire for death, this begins to describe a much smaller cohort of patients, a small but significant minority, about 8.5%. Next slide, please. So the next question then is, what differentiates those patients who have a genuine desire to die, who wish life to be over, versus those who don't have any such feelings or don't covet any genuine feelings around the wish for life to be over sooner than later? And what you can see here are some of the things that we measured in our study, going beyond the Brown study, which looked primarily at depression. We, for instance, looked at pain and found that patients who desired life to be over sooner than later, about 80% of instances had pain of moderate severity or greater. So pain seemed to be a player amongst patients who had a genuine desire to die. We then looked at family support, and amongst patients who had a genuine wish to die, there was either the perception or the reality that somehow families were less available or less supportive. In the middle there, in blue or light green, depending on what it's coming out as on the other side of the world, in terms of the slide and how it's presenting, you see depression. And what you can see is that depression along a causal pathway lies closest to the issue of desire for death. And what we found is that the single most ardent predictor of a desire for death was syndromal depression. And amongst people who had a wish to die, the prevalence of depression was close to something in the magnitude of about 70%, compared to about 7 to 8% of patients who did not have a genuine desire for die. So again, what this says is at the bedside, when patients are expressing this form of anguish, we should begin to think about the multitude of factors that may influence or that may undermine their wish to go on living. And part of good palliative care is trying to understand and trying to mitigate sources of suffering. And certainly the expression of the wish to die is one way that patients might express that suffering. Next slide, please. Now, the previous studies, in some ways, if I think about it, I mean, they used a metaphor that I would think about as a camera or a snapshot. In other words, in cross-section, what I've told you about is what a desire for death looks like at a given point in time. However, again, for those of you who are working in palliative care, if there's one thing that's predictable, it's that things change. You know, the clinical circumstances you see this morning are not necessarily the clinical circumstances that you will see later on in the day when you visit the patients, because things can change and things can change quickly. And I think that's why probably part of the WHO definition of palliative care is kind of the anticipation of suffering, and good palliative care is anticipation of symptoms and trying to preempt symptoms before they occur. So in some ways what we understood then is we needed to change our metaphor, and changing our metaphor meant that we needed to change the way in which we were planning our research and the kind of research design that would make sense if we were going to try and follow this construct, which we then called will to live. What we did in this particular study is we used a revised version of the ESAS. For those of you who aren't familiar with the ESAS, this is an instrument that was developed by Eduardo Barrera, a very eminent palliative care researcher in the world, who for many years worked in Edmonton, Canada, a province just to the east, just northeast of Winnipeg. And they developed, or he developed along with his team, something called the Edmonton System Assessment Scale. And it consists of a series of visual analogs, so from 0 to 10, you know, what degree of pain are you experiencing, what degree of nausea, what degree of fatigue, what degree of well-being, and so on. And any score that is high on the ESUS is reflective of distress. So we added a will-to-live visual analog. So a high score on a will-to-live visual analog is actually reflective of a paucity, a lack of will to live. What do you see in this particular study? Well, going from left to right, this is a woman with end-stage colorectal cancer. Again, this study was comprised of about 200 patients, all of them receiving palliative care. And what I've done here is I've parsed out an individual piece of data in which I've tracked her will to live. And what you can see is that initially, when she makes the transition from being an outpatient to now coming into palliative care, her score on this visual analog is high. In other words, she's reflecting a paucity or a lack of will to live. Immediately upon entering palliative care, you can see that the scores drop, which means her will to live improves. And then towards the end of her life, will to live becomes actually more erratically reported. Once a patient was no longer competent, we stopped collecting data. We felt that we couldn't collect meaningful data at that time. What does this tell us? Well, first of all, it tells us that will to live, even though this is a nebulous and vague construct, is something that we can try and get a handle on. Even though it's difficult to objectify some of these existential issues, we can, if we put our minds to it, try and quantify in a way that is meaningful to patients what their outlook is in a very deep spiritual or existential way. The other thing we can see, as I said, is that the video cam metaphor is an appropriate one, because if there's nothing else that we can notice from this slide, it's the fact that things change, that initially she may be reporting one kind of reality, but soon after she enters into palliative care, she's experiencing and expressing and reporting a very different reality, which again shifts as death ensues. Next slide, please. Now, this is a particularly fascinating slide, and one that I've showed in many parts of the world, because to my mind, in many ways, it's emblematic of what we do in palliative care. And by that, what I mean is that even though we measure these constructs as if they exist in silos, the reality is that human experience doesn't exist in silos. You know, things that affect physical dimensions of our experience also affect existential and spiritual dimensions of our experience. What you're seeing in this slide in red is her subjective sense of pain. And superimposed with that is her subjective sense of will to live. And if we, again, sticking with the metaphor language, if we were using a metaphor of dancing, this would be a tango. And it's a very intimate dance in which pain and will to live are in very close juxtaposition one to the other. And so what can we say? Well, perhaps as her pain improves, and again, all patients are receiving exemplary quality end-of-life care, so too does her will to live. Because of the nature of this data, we can't necessarily talk about cause and effect. So it could be that now that she's in palliative care, now that her psychosocial needs are being met, perhaps her spiritual needs are being met, perhaps many of the pressures that she's experiencing outside of hospital have now been lifted from her shoulders, her experience of pain is influenced in a favorable way. But either which way, what it does say is that whatever area we happen to be working in, our actions have ripple effects across a multitude of domains that really make up what we think of or call patient experience. Good pain management has spiritual outcomes, and good spiritual and existential and psychological management can profoundly influence the way we experience nociceptive pain. Next slide, please. So you can well imagine that doing work of this kind and preceding this work, we had published some studies on depression, on hopelessness, on suicidality. And when you're doing that kind of work, and at the same time in the political arena, people are debating this issue of assisted suicide and euthanasia, it's little wonder that we would both be drawn into that conversation, and we would be attracted to that conversation. So, as we know, in the Benelux countries, practices around euthanasia and assisted suicide had been taking place for many years, for decades. And we began to look at some of the studies that had been done. One of the studies was one that was done by Paul Vandermas in Holland, and he was looking at the prevalence of what they called MDEL, or medical decisions to end life. And what he reported, in fact, has been replicated in various different studies across time and in various different jurisdictions wherein euthanasia and assisted suicide practices are available. And that is the prevalence of medical decisions to end life, if we're talking about euthanasia, approximates somewhere between 3.5 and 4% of deaths. So in Holland, about 4% of deaths are accounted for by euthanasia. Euthanasia is the administration of a toxic agent by a healthcare professional that will directly result in the death of that individual. Assisted suicide, on the other hand, is the provision of means by a healthcare provider to a patient for that individual to take, for example, a medication in most instances, in all instances, a medication that they might choose to take or not at a time of their choosing. Now, that kind of information was interesting to us. You know, it says something about how people are managing angst. It says something about how people are prepared to respond in the face of this kind of anguish. But it's still using a quantitative approach. And in fact, the qualitative study that Vandermas embedded in that particular study that I'm mentioning is one that I'll refer to now. Next slide. So Vandermas had a challenge because he was interested not only in the prevalence of MDEL, but he was interested in the question why. Why is it that patients were seeking out this method of dying? Now, methodologically, you can see that there's some real challenges here because the people who are of interest are no longer of this world. So they have since died at the hands of Dutch physicians who have provided either euthanasia, much more commonly, or assisted suicide. So Vandermas went back to the death record, took note of those in which one of those forms of MDL was implicated, and then the name of the physician. And he contacted some of those physicians to ask them, to interview them, why is it, in your estimation, patients sought out this kind of assistance? And if we start at the bottom of the slide, you can see that although pain, you might have anticipated, would be one of the big players, what was found in the Vandermas trial is that pain alone only accounted for 5% of instances that motivated a patient to end their life. Pain is part of a constellation of symptoms, second from the top, 49%. But then you start to get some of these other things that are kind of vague or nebulous: tiredness of life, unworthy dying, fears around being dependent. But at the top of the list was this notion of lost dignity. We had done a search on dignity subsequent to seeing this, and what you see is that dignity is used all over the map. I mean, dignity is used as a trump card. It's used to support whatever contentious position you might happen to hold in end-of-life care. So whether you're talking about assisted suicide or euthanasia, hydration, nutrition, dignity is the card that you play. You say that if this is about dignity and euthanasia, dignity is all about autonomy. And so the preservation of autonomy would allow people to control the timing and circumstances of their death. And if you're on the opposite side of that political offense, you might say, well, I mean, the taking of human life is an affront to human dignity. What we didn't find in the literature was any empirical data around the notion of dignity from the vantage point of dying patients. And what you can see is that although this study put dignity in our map, there were a number of problems. First off, the authors didn't provide an a priori definition of what they meant by dignity. And the source of the information was at least one step removed. It wasn't the patients who were reporting lost sense of dignity. It was the physicians who were involved in providing a means of hastening their death that were saying loss of dignity in most instances or most frequently was the reason that I felt that my patient might have been seeking out a hastened death. Next slide, please. And so this really began us on a path of empirical dignity research, and the first slide in some ways looks very similar to the Desire for Death study. We designed a dignity measure, again, based on the SAS interview, the Schedule of Affective Disorders in Schizophrenia, in which you can see that a 1 is a minimal loss sense of dignity, about 30% said they had minimal loss sense of dignity. But if we go to the 4, strong or a moderate, I should say a 3, a moderate sense of loss sense of dignity regards the problem as significant. We're talking about 7% of this cohort who reported that loss sense of dignity in the throes of anticipating death was something that they reported as being problematic. So in some ways, that came as a surprise, because you would think in the wake of anticipating loss of life that affronts to dignity, when you consider the slings and arrows that are thrown our way, loss of dignity might have been cited much more frequently. Why might that not have been the case? Some of our patients took a very spiritual or religious attitude toward the notion of dignity and said that dignity was God-given. It was something that was part of their humanity. And so as long as there was life, there was dignity. And a more secular, perhaps, way formulation of the results is to say that, you know, all of these patients were receiving exemplary quality end-of-life care. So they're receiving good pain management, they're receiving good psychosocial care, existential support, psychological support. And so it raises the question, in the absence of that kind of care, might dignity itself be more vulnerable? And so, like with the Desire for Death study, we asked the question, what differentiates patients whose dignity is intact versus those whose dignity is undermined, or as we called it in some of our writings, fractured? Next slide, please. Well, if you look at the psychological issues, in some ways, there's no surprises, and that is patients who reported a lost sense of dignity were more likely to say, my desire for death is higher. I've lost my will to live. And they're experiencing a constellation of psychological symptoms such as depression, hopelessness, and anxiety. So in some ways, loss of dignity might be part of a final common pathway in which people lose their sense of dignity. As a result, they lose their will to live. And ergo, it may result in a higher likelihood of requests around euthanasia or assisted suicide. Next slide, please. What happens when we look at the physical dimensions that may differentiate patients whose dignity is intact versus those that is fractured? Well, some of the players that appear on the scene are of little surprise. Pain might be a player. Difficulty with bowel functioning, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, but these, what we called, and you'll hear in the next slide, something we called the intimacies of care, or something as physically bound as how we actually look or how we think we appear in the eyes of others. Next slide, please. Then comes the issue of what we called the intimate dependencies. It's a lovely term. I don't lay credit to it. It was something that actually my biostatistician, Tom Hazard, came up with. These are the intimacies of care. These are intimacies that any of us in the throes of a serious illness may find ourselves dependent on others in ways that we, from a vantage point of good health, might find unimaginable. If we were to segue at this point into a conversation about compassion, what I would be saying is that many of these intimate dependencies are things that really don't appear on the radar of healthcare providers. I mean, those of us who take care of patients don't necessarily bear witness to any of this because it takes place behind closed curtains. These are the things that are going on in hospitals and personal care homes, not only around New Zealand and Canada, but around the world. But if we were to look at trying to engender or attempting to try and engender a sense of compassion and amongst healthcare providers, we would say it's important, at least in a moment, to try and personalize this and to imagine what would it be like for ourselves or someone that we love to be dependent in these ways. And we've heard it from our patients or we've heard it from loved ones. If ever I were dependent in that way, it would undermine my wish to go on. It would undermine my very sense of my own humanity. Next slide, please. Now, at this point, I could be showing you the results of what was come about as a result of a logistic regression model. And these models actually, I mean, allow you to do some very fancy number crunching. And because we've looked at a multitude of issues that might predict a desire for a hastened death, or loss of dignity, I should say, we could say, well, is there some hierarchy of importance? I mean, what is most likely, if we had to predict, what is most likely to undermine a dying patient's sense of dignity? And although I'm not showing you the logistic regression model, what I'm showing you is an etching by a Dutch artist named M.C. Escher. And what you can see, and this is a self-portrait, by the way, of the artist, and I choose to see this as the eye of a healthcare provider. At the time when I wrote the article that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, I called this Dignity in the Eye of the Beholder. Perhaps a hokey title at this point in time, I think I might use the language of witness, which is something that I've been, language that I've been including in some of my more recent writings, because those of us in healthcare bear witness to the experience of our patients, and the point that this picture is making, this etching is making, and the point that the model makes is the most ardent predictor of lost sense of dignity was the notion of appearance, or how we perceive ourselves to appear in the eyes of others. And what you can see is that in the eye of the beholder, the healthcare provider, if rather than what you're seeing, you were seeing a problem checklist, you know, you were seeing a group of symptoms or a group of medications or a group of alternatives that might be tried to try and mitigate suffering, then the individual is likely to feel that they've been reduced to their ailment. But on the other hand, what do we see? Well, we see a reflection of the artist in the eye of the beholder, in the eye of the witness. And you can see that this is a middle-aged, debonair man. He's in his apartment. He's surrounded by books. He's surrounded by his belongings, by photographs, and by pictures. In other words, what he is seeing in the eye of the beholder is an affirmation of self. It's an affirmation of personhood. And certainly one of the things that we see is, you know, the fear amongst patients that patienthood is somehow going to eclipse personhood. Now, up until this point in time, and next slide, please, I've treated dignity in the same way, you know, you would treat a salami. You know, that is that you carve it up, you throw it on a scale using an ordinal measure, you weigh it, and you say, okay, I get it, I understand it, and I've reported the model to you. And even though that sounds like I'm being slightly denigrating of the quantitative approach, I mean nothing of the kind. But dignity is much more than a 0 to 10 scale or a 0 to 6 scale using that scale models on the SADS interview. It has many more textures, it has many more layers, which is why we went about looking at dignity using qualitative approaches. And this particular model has appeared in a number of publications, both in social science and medicine, and as well in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Because of lack of time, and I do want to leave some time at the end for some questions, I'll try and go through this relatively quickly. This is an empirical model of dignity in the terminally ill. Some might say it's the best model. Some might say it's the worst model. My retort would be it's the only model. It's the only model that has gotten empirical data from dying patients themselves to say, what is it that supports your dignity? What is it that undermines your dignity? We then use the grounded theory approach in trying to look at the predominant themes, and you see the listing of themes under the major categories from left to right, beginning with illness-related concerns. So these are aspects of dignity that seem to be implicated or seem to be affected by the illness itself. And many of the things under illness-related concerns, you would say, are very typical of the work we do in palliative care. And in some ways, I like to think of this model as being a map. And a map is something that helps you get to a place that's difficult to reach or helps you to reach places that you were entirely unaware of. And as I mentioned, many of the things on this map are typical of the known map in palliative care, which is, you know, you try and attend to cognitive acuity by treating delirium, by, you know, trying to avoid polypharmacy when you can. You try and optimize functional capacity, and certainly symptoms distress is a huge part of what's done in palliative care and trying to mitigate physical distress. But if you look under psychological distress, what do you begin to see? You begin to see some things that aren't necessarily on the map, like medical uncertainty, not knowing what death is going to look like, and death anxiety. I'm the chair and founder of a project called the Canadian Virtual Hospice, and one of the most frequently downloaded articles from that site, virtualhospice.ca, and it's free of charge, and in New Zealand you can certainly go online, and there's a wealth of information at no charge for patients and families and healthcare providers that I think you'll find really quite extraordinary. And it lends empirical support to the idea that for many dying patients, it's what they don't know, not being able to anticipate what death might look like, that might undermine their sense of dignity. If we go to the far right of that particular model, you see something called the social dignity inventory. And we know that, you know, from writings that have been done on the issue of dignity, there's this idea of extrinsic dignity. So there's the internally held dignity, a dignity that people sort of define as part of their humanity, that no matter who we are and what state we may be in, that dignity is part and parcel of being human. Extrinsic dignity says that dignity is something that can also be reinforced or undermined based on what happens in the surround of that individual. So do we respect that individual's privacy, counterbalanced by providing the appropriate kind of social support? Below that, you see a construct that we call care tenor. And it becomes it's a very important construct. It refers to the tone of care. One palliative care nurse said to me when I explained, she said, "Oh, I've always thought of that as the fragrance of care. You know, it's that ineffable thing that patients sense when you walk into a room, and that ineffable thing is about a sense of being affirmed, a sense of being understood, being seen not only in terms of your illness and defined not only in terms of your illness, but also that definition including your sense of who you are as an individual." The issue of feeling a burden to others, and of course that's something that can be externally reinforced depending on the disposition of the family member. And then something related to burden to others, but not quite the same thing, because it's a fear of not being a burden in the here now, but the burden that I will place on my family in the absence of my being. And then in the middle category, the dignity-conserving repertoire, as you can see, is the most complex, as you might anticipate it, because it's the combination of psychological and spiritual issues that can have an influence on sense of dignity. And it can include anything from, you know, do I have a continued sense of self or a sense of purpose, a kind of role preservation. Generativity turned out to be an important issue, and I'll have a moment near the end to talk about something called dignity therapy. And for many patients, the thing that can undermine their sense of dignity is, how will I be remembered? Will I have an opportunity for my life to have some sort of ripple effect? Will those who live beyond me have lives that are in part shaped or influenced by the fact that I was known, the fact that I was here? Maintaining pride, hopefulness is not about, you know, the hope for cure or hope for an unreasonable period a protracted survival. But what we found is that towards the end of life, hope and hopefulness, it's the only time that hope becomes uncoupled from the issue of future expectation. And what I mean by that is one can maintain hope even in the absence of anticipation of future expectation, because it really is about meaning and purpose. And you can see there are a number of other issues that are included there, including spiritual resilience. Now, what did we do with this model? Because what you can say is that if you're going to try and bring dignity to the bedside, what you ought to do is you ought to take the empirical model or the empirical evidence that you have around the issue of dignity and use it as best you can to inform instruments, to inform approaches, attitudes, and outlook that might have an influence on sense of dignity. So, for example, we developed something that we called the Patient Dignity Inventory. And again, if you go to dignityandcare.ca or you just look up Patient Dignity Inventory, you'll see this instrument is available and it's free online in various different forms that are, you know, more or less patient-friendly that they can either fill out themselves or that you can use to ask questions of the patient. And what's interesting about this measure is that not only does it cover the physical dimensions of end-of-life care, and we can be assured that, you know, every patient in palliative care at least once on a daily basis will be asked about their pain and about their bowel movements, but what about the existential, the spiritual, the psychosocial issues? And some of these issues are deeply spiritual and existential. Number 11 is feeling like I'm no longer the person who I was. This was one of the issues that very much was cited by patients as being something that could influence or undermine their sense of dignity, feeling that they were no longer the sense of who they were. And so in some ways, this is meant to provide palliative care clinicians with a new lens. And the exciting thing about a new lens, like when you get new glasses, you know, you can see a little better than you could see before. Perhaps you could see things that you didn't see before. Next slide, please. And in case I've fallen behind on slides, there should be a slide that reads the Patient Dignity Inventory, applications in the oncology setting. So we did a naturalistic study in which we gave this to psychosocial oncology professionals across the country, and if memory serves me, there were somewhere between 80 to 100 palliative care clinicians who took part in this study, and we asked them to use this in a naturalistic way in their oncology populations. And what did we end up learning? Well, that's a variety of things, including this gave patients language. The Patient Dignity Inventory gave patients language to express what otherwise was kind of more nebulous angst. You know, I feel terrible. You know, I don't feel good. You know, I don't feel right. I don't feel like I'm the person that I was. This provides language to be able to articulate in a more granular way what some of those things might be about. But as interesting to me is that in 80% of instances in this particular study, patients identified issues that for clinicians, or let me put it a different way around, clinicians identified issues that were articulated by patients in 80% of instances that they were previously unaware of. Now, that doesn't mean that the Patient Dignity Inventory is meant to replace conversations, not at all, but it can help you direct you to which doorway you might want to open up a conversation in. And so it allows you to be much more strategic. It allows you and gives you clues into where the patient may be at so that you can begin to see their lived experience or the patient experience in a much more informed way. Next slide, please. So our group has taken this notion of how we see patients in a very tangible way, and we think in a very serious way. I'd always thought about good end-of-life care, about what we do with patients and what we do with patients and their families, and yet the evidence seems to be saying that good palliative care has to do with all of that and more, and the more includes how do we see patients. Next slide, please. And so this notion of what we do with patients, what we do for patients, and how we see patients was subsumed in a new model of palliative care that we call dignity-conserving care, and this appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was called a new model for palliative care. Next slide, please. I'm going to move through this next section relatively quickly. And it really is meant to give you a mnemonic, a way of remembering some of the things that you may want to be thinking about when it comes to delivering dignity-conserving care at the bedside for patients. And again, the person who's implicated in this work, for better or for worse, is you. This is called Dignity and the Essence of Medicine, the ABCDs of Dignity Conserving Care. These are in the public domain, and we've paid for open access, so this is available from the website from the British Medical Journal. And what this says is that there are, just like in critical care, there are the ABCs of critical care, there are the ABCDs of Dignity Conserving Care, and no more so than the ABCs are something that are optional for good quality care. The ABCDs, the humanities of care, and the things that reinforce the humanities of care shouldn't be optional, but they should be central and part and parcel of good quality, not only end-of-life care, but medical care. So next slide, please. And this slide should read, A, dignity-conserving care attitude. And again, what this says is that how you see patients, and remember the that etching by Escher, and you know, I would like to think that every healthcare provider should have a copy of that etching in his or her office, because it's a reminder of the opportunity for affirmation. No matter what position we hold in end-of-life care, whether we're the surgeon making the first incision or we're the person who's at the triage desk and triaging, you know, what the patient might need or want or require at that point in time, we have an opportunity by virtue of our attitude to either provide affirmation or to not provide affirmation. Next slide, please. Now, so it doesn't sound like I'm pontificating, what I've done here is I've shown you the results from a study that said which of these things are affiliated with sense of dignity towards the end of life. And you can see, for example, and this is in ascending order, so 41-42% say thinking how life might end, that certainly might have an influence on my sense of dignity being intact. Next slide, please. You can see number 9, no longer feeling like who you were, a deeply existential questions, and 75% of patients said that is something that could undermine my sense of dignity. And I would bet that it's probably been a little while since you've asked your patient whether or not they feel like they're the person who they once were. Now, sometimes clinicians will say to me, well, what's the point? I mean, what am I supposed to do with that? I mean, you know, I mean, at least if I ask them about pain, I know what to do with that. I can do something to mitigate pain, but how do I mitigate a feeling of no longer feeling like who you were? And my retort is to say, try and avoid the feeling or the need to fix. It takes a real element or modicum of what I call therapeutic humility to ask questions for which you know there are no readily apparent answers. And the reality is that simply asking the question is already a way of opening up a dialogue that can, in very many ways, be healing and comforting. You know, that this person recognizes that in many ways, I don't feel like the man or woman, the boy or girl that I used to be. Next slide, please. And again, if we go to the very bottom of that slide, you can say that feeling a burden to others, in other words, my life has no value. It's the equivalent of existential extremists. And at the very same rate, 87.1, not being treated with respect or understanding. And if you feel your life has no value and serves no purpose, is it any wonder that you're going to feel that you are a burden to others, that my life has no meaning? What does this have to do with attitude? The reality is that either you can affirm, you can bestow respect, or you can withhold respect. B stands for behavior, and certainly once your attitude, and you're aware that your attitude can either provide or withhold affirmation, behaviors are going to change. So, for example, next slide, Do we sit or stand by the bedside? Do we meet them at their level or do we stand over them? Do we meet their gaze or do we avert their gaze? Next slide, please. This is an interesting study that tried to give, again, empirical validity to this notion of sitting versus standing. This was a study in which surgeons, prior to walking into the room of patients post-spinal surgery, were asked to be to take a chip that either randomized them to sitting and doing their first post-surgical consultation versus standing doing their first post-surgical consultation. And what you can see in the top slide on the left of that graph is that the amount of time that the physician sat when they were randomized to the sitting position was about a minute. So they came into the room and asked some questions and in about a minute covered the things that needed to be covered in this first post-spinal surgery consultation. And yet the perception of the patient, just going over slightly to the right, the larger bar, is that according to the perception of the patient, the amount of time that they'd been with the physician was five times longer. And if you go to the right of that slide, what you can see is that when the physician was standing, although they were still only actually there for a little over a minute, again, really no difference, that the amount of time from the perception of the patient was far less. They perceived that they were there about three times longer than they had been. But if you go to the bottom slide, and this is where things become really important, and that is that in nearly 100% of instances, in instances when the physician was sitting, the patient said, I experienced this interaction as being positive. It met my needs. Where, as you look in the over to the left, in only about 60% of instances did patients feel that their needs were met. So in about 40% of instances when the physician stood, even though the time was identical, almost about a minute, patients somehow didn't feel that they had been understood in the same way. Next slide, please. Compassion, what we can say about compassion and what we know about compassion, it's the empathy, the notion of understanding the suffering another, along with the wish to be able to respond to that person's anguish so that we can mitigate their suffering. Next slide, please. This is a photograph of Stuart Farber, and he was a palliative care physician at the University of Washington. Prior to his death, he wrote a beautiful piece reflecting on personhood and what he referred to thread in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. And here's what he wrote. He said, "With rare exception, the clinicians who treated me have good hearts. They care deeply, but possessed little or no knowledge of my thread. My thread is the narrative I use to make sense of my life. It is longitudinal, nonlinear, emotional, filled with contradictions, and integrates my life experiences into a coherent whole. It is within the values and meanings of my story that treatment decisions are made. What contributes to meaning and quality is not about living longer, but living a life that is consistent with my thread. Without knowing my thread, it is impossible for a clinician to provide respectful care." So this is really quite extraordinary. Stuart Farber is saying that, you know, in order for my needs to be met, it's important not only that all of the things that are normally done on behalf of me in the context of palliative care be done, but that I be understood. And this is important in terms of compassion, because to truly understand compassion, one has to take it on outside of the intellectual sphere and try and understand it on an emotional level, that like our patients, we too can suffer. Next slide, this is D for dialogue, and these are conversations that reinforce or support the notion of dignity near the end of life. So let me share with you two other quick studies that really have to do with the kinds of conversations that we might have with patients that hopefully can provide recognition of personhood and this element of affirmation. Next slide, please. The first is what we called the patient dignity question, and this was a study that was published in the journal Cancer, and again, it's available on open access, and these references are all available on the dignityandcare.ca website, or you can just Google my name, Chachanov, and the patient dignity question, and you get the details of this study. How do you study this patient dignity question, which we defined as, what should I know about you as a person to help me take the best care of you that I can. What we did is we went to the bedside of patients in palliative care. This was done exclusively on an inpatient setting. And we said, you know, we know a lot about you as a patient. We know a lot about you and about your illness and things that are on your chart. We know less about you as a person, as a human being, about, you know, what your family would say about you as a person. So tell me, what should I know about you so that I can take the best care of you possible? We then had this brief conversation, 5 to 10 minutes. We would go off, we would summarize this in a paragraph or two, and we would come back to the bedside for three reasons. One, to read it in its entirety. Two, to affirm that this is indeed what they had said and they were satisfied with their the transcribed response to the PDQ, the patient dignity question. And three, this is the litmus test. Is this something that you would give us permission to place on your chart? Because then, again, if we're taking seriously this notion of changing the lens, how we see people, placing this on your chart in essence is saying, this is the lens through which I wish to be seen. Next slide, please. This is an 82-year-old woman with colorectal cancer. She was a First Nations woman, and many of you will be familiar with Canada's shameful history of the residential school system, in which patients were taken out of their families as a way of trying to steal away their language and culture. And she said that because of the residential school, she thought I would have a hard time trusting people. She, in fact, moved 82 times, so as not to let anyone get too close to her. Well, this had gotten better over time. She still struggles with being able to trust people. She wants to, but it's hard for her. She sometimes worries that she won't be told the whole truth or that people will not see her as being deserving of the whole truth. She appreciates people being friendly towards her, but is frightened of authority figures. Authority scares me, but I'm not as bad as I used to be. And so I would say to you, is it possible for us really to provide dignity-conserving care, to provide this kind of holistic care that affirms not only patienthood but personhood without knowing her thread? When you think about somebody walking in with a white coat, there is a subtext that we are entirely unaware of unless we know her thread and unless we know of the power differential that is defined by virtue of the fact that we're in the white coat and she is not. Next slide, please. This is just giving the demographics of a group of patients who participated in this study. We either had patients or their family members when they could no longer speak on behalf of themselves. And again, going quickly, I can say that if we had enough time, you can see that these family members know their loved one extremely well. Next slide, please. What do we found? Well, we found that invariably patients and family responses to the PDQ were uniformly favorable. 99% said that it was accurate. 97% said they wanted it placed on the chart. In other words, this is the lens. A number of them wanted copies. They said that it would inform their practice in 91% of instances. That it would affect their care in 91% of instances, and I would assume it would affect their tone of care, and that in almost every instance they would recommend it for other patients and family members. And what did healthcare providers say? Well, what they said is that in the majority of instances, they learned something new that they didn't previously know in about 90% of instances. And then you can see in a variety of measures we took that this also influenced dimensions of empathy and compassion. And although those weren't as high as 90%, you have to remember that this is in a cohort of individuals who were wired for empathy in that they are part of the palliative care team. I'm afraid I'm going to have very little time to talk about dignity therapy, which is modeled on the empirical model of dignity in the terminally ill. Dignity therapy is a brief individualized psychotherapy that is transcribed. It is guided by a trained therapist to say things that people would want said. So it can be biographical. It can speak to issues around continuity of self or things they continue to take pride in. It can look after the well-being of loved ones or family members that you're about to leave behind. And the tone of care or social support needs to be in a very Carl Rogers-like way, something that is very affirming and non-judgmental. For those of you who are interested in reading about dignity therapy, I had a book published a number of years ago called Dignity Therapy, Final Words for Final Days, and it gives the most detailed description of dignity therapy. Next slide, please. This should be reading Dignity Therapy Study, although it reads preliminary data. This was the final data that we reported on the first study, which again showed that in a non-controlled circumstances, that patients were satisfied, they found it helpful, that it increased their sense of dignity, heightened their sense of meaning and purpose. Next slide, please. In studies that have looked at family outcomes, invariably family members have said that this has been helpful to them. In almost 75% of instances, or 65% of instances, they said it's been as helpful as any other facet of their end-of-life care. Next slide, please. There have currently been about 100 papers on dignity therapy. About 30 of these have reported primary data analyses. What the studies have found is that there's uniform satisfaction, that dimensions of end-of-life care experience have been improved. When base rates of distress are low, it is very difficult to show significant outcomes on primary measures such as depression or anxiety. In other studies where base rates of distress are high, and there's a particular study that came out of Portugal, it showed that in randomized control conditions that dignity therapy was able to influence depression, anxiety, and demoralization.